WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump has authorized covert CIA operations in Venezuela, blaming it for drug trafficking and sending prisoners and others to the U.S.
I think Venezuela is feeling heat, but I think a lot of other countries are feeling heat, too. We're not going to let this country, our country, be ruined because other people want to drop, as you say, their worst. They have given us their worst.
President Trump will meet tomorrow with Ukraine's President Zelensky. Charlie Daggett reports the president has mentioned providing Ukraine with long-range missiles.
Wants to know how they're going to be used and what they're going to be targeting. Again, no green light on the Tomahawks, but that will be front and center to their discussions tomorrow.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's plane was forced to make an emergency landing in Britain today due to a crack in the windshield. Many journalists at the Pentagon turned in their badges today after refusing to agree to new restrictions. On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed. CBS News Brief, I'm Cammy McCormick.
97.5 WFHR, locally grown radio, and home for the Todd Allball Show, Monday through Friday from 2 to 4.
For WFHR and WIRI News, I'm Melissa Kay. The high school football playoffs will be different this year across Wisconsin. Jimmy Cuska reports.
October is the start of high school football playoffs, and this season, for the first time, teams will qualify using a new system. The new system, which was supported by nearly 90% of coaches before implementation, essentially rewards teams that win, and especially by defeating good teams. In addition to figuring out who makes the playoffs, the new system also seeds each team and assigns them geographically between four regions, a process that used to be done in the past by humans with the aid of computer formulas. Teams also know which division they are playing in at the start of the season. In the past, the divisions were set by dividing the qualifying teams equally between divisions the day after the regular season ended. The 8-player playoff bracket was announced last Saturday, with the 11-player playoff bracket to be announced this Saturday. You can see the playoff qualifying report for football and details on the new playoff qualification system on the WIAA website.
Portage County is hosting a virtual public information meeting later this month to share updates from its countywide traffic safety study. The virtual meeting will take place on Tuesday, October 28th from 6 to 7 p.m., Portage County Planning and Zoning Planner Kristen Johnson said, quote, "This study is about listening to the community and using that feedback to guide our approach to roadway safety. By combining data from our demonstration projects with input from residents, we can build a safety action plan that reflects the needs of Portage County," end quote. The meeting will share data collected from roadway safety demonstration projects installed in the county from April through October. Community members will have the opportunity to provide feedback during the meeting. You can register by visiting the county website at co.portage.wi.gov. I'm Melissa Kay for WFHR and WIRI News. You can find more news anytime and sign up for our newsletter at WFHR.com.
The Brewers head to L.A. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, baseball, Game 3 of the NLCS. Tomorrow evening at 5:08 between the Brewers and Dodgers, the crew losing last night's game 5-1. Do the Brewers need to improve their focus? Pitcher Freddy Peralta.
Yeah, we have to, 100%. It's not fun to be 0-2, you know, going to L.A. I think we have to turn the page and try to come back in Los Angeles.
The Brewers have only 2 runs on 5 hits for the series so far. They've struck out 15 times. Pat Murphy.
You know, we chased way more than we've chased all year. We've been the best in baseball at not chasing. These pitchers brought out the worst in us.
NBA, the Bucks lose to the Thunder, 116-112 at Fiserv Forum in their final preseason game.
Again, it was not the best basketball game, but offensively, we were really good. If we can play the same type of offense that we played tonight, you know, we're going to be pretty happy.
That's Giannis Antetokounmpo with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Catch Farm Report updates throughout the day from the Midwest Farm Report right here on 97.5 WFHR.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight, maybe a stray shower and a low in the mid-40s. A cloudy day for tomorrow, showers around, highs upper 50s to near 60. A mostly cloudy day for Friday and warmer, a high in the low 70s with a slight chance of rain. Right now it's 53.
Seems like nobody in America agrees on much of anything these days.
But can we agree the federal government shouldn't tax people into poverty?
If you work full-time, you should be able to afford your basic needs. Don't you think? We're the Patriotic Millionaires.
We believe your full-time job should cover what it costs to live. We think your first $45,000 of income should be tax-free.
And multimillionaires?
We should pay more to fund your tax cut. Go to first45taxfree.com to learn more. A working-class tax cut paid for by millionaires. That's an idea we can all agree on.
This message is for Karina, our mom who finished her high school diploma at age 28. Hi, Mom. It's Amethyst and Nicholas.
Congratulations on getting your diploma.
You worked so hard and have taught us so much.
We love you.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Chihuahua. On the next Nightlight, I welcome comedian, TV host, and host of the Travel Tales podcast, Mike Siegel. Then Tim Sowers from the Overture Center joins me to light it up.
Nightlight with Chihuahua. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
They wish to break the entire thing. That is the objective. It isn't about efficiency. It's about breaking it. And it's about breaking it for what end?
Now, the Maggie Dawn Show continues.
Gerrymandering is bad for everybody.
From Congress and courts to burgers and baseball.
I'm grossly discouraged, and I have given up on any justice in our system. It doesn't exist anymore.
Once again, here's lawyer and economist Maggie Dawn.
Keep hope alive, friends. Justice does exist. I have true faith that our institutions will hold and that we can move our dialogue about being a democratic republic forward and that we're going to be able to do this together. And I've got two experts for this entire hour to help us delve into these, I don't know, they sometimes seem very theoretical, but what they are very real questions for all of us every day in our conversations with coworkers, friends and families, and in pews and on bar stools, as I like to say, in parks, and you know, when we're walking the pavements. It is about you and the dialogue that we're having with one another. I've got two great experts. First, you know him very well as Marquette University Law School's polar extraordinaire, the one, the only, Mr. Charles Franklin. Welcome back to the program, Charles. It's great to have you with us this afternoon, sir.
Always great to be here. Thank you.
We're also joined this hour by Professor Barry Burden of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the director of the Elections Research Center and is the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics. He's focused on civic engagement. Yes, I said civic engagement, which doesn't just mean in the voting box or in the ballot box, the voting booth, but how we collectively are engaging with the most important public policy debates and issues of our time. He looks at election administration, the actual process by which we cast our votes. He looks at public opinion polling, representation, and voting behavior. He is co-editor of The Measure of American Elections and author of The Personal Roots of Representation and a book that I am clearly going to be buying, Why Americans Split Their Tickets, Campaigns, Competition, and Divided Government. Welcome, Barry. It's great to have you, Professor.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's just jump right in. We are now looking at a mid-decade gerrymander, Professor Burden, and it is one that could fundamentally change the outcome of the balance of power in 2026. In terms of how the parties have been approaching this and the impact that this may have either to increase participation in elections and voter engagement, civic engagement, or to really drive people away from the ballot boxes to disengage, where do you think this falls? Because, you know, a lot of people have been talking about the scourge of gerrymandering for a very long time. This seems to be sort of the apex of that problem.
Yeah, it's really the continuation of a lot of hardball politics. You know, when you've got very narrow majorities in the House and Senate, it's a few votes in the House. We're still waiting to seat one newly elected member from New Mexico who's a Democrat. Senate is a 53-47 margin. Each party is looking for a little edge it can give itself next year. And historically, the president's party would suffer in a midterm election. And this is an especially unpopular president. His approval rating is sitting in the low 40s in most surveys. You'd expect Republicans probably to lose the House and maybe be at risk in the Senate. So they're looking for seats. And this redistricting gimmick is the way to do it. I think it's going to help them just in terms of winning seats. They're likely to pick up five more in Texas if that's not struck down by a court. They're looking at Missouri and North Carolina and Indiana and some other states as well. Democrats are countering in California, but it's not going to be enough just in terms of the math. But I think it will energize some Democratic voters who are unhappy with everything that's going on in Washington. Some of them are going to be at the No Kings rally this weekend and other things, and they're looking for an electoral outlet to that. And the midterm election is a natural place where angry people show up and vote against the party in power. And, you know, layering on these redistricting gimmicks on top of everything else that Democrats are unhappy about, I think can only be motivating for them.
Do we end up with a House of Representatives that isn't representative of the vast majority, or certainly a plurality, or a slightly over 50% that just isn't representative of where the majority of Americans are?
I'd say it's already that to some degree. Hmm. You know, the makeup of the states is kind of strange and arbitrary. Every state gets two senators, whether you're little Wyoming with basically the population of Dane County, Wisconsin, is the whole state of Wyoming. They get two U.S. senators. California has 30 million people and gets two U.S. senators. So there's already a skew built in, and the drawing of districts, either intentionally or unintentionally, usually favors, in recent years, the GOP, though in the past, it sometimes helped Democrats. So this is going to stack it further, I think, and probably make congressional elections less meaningful if you can create more safe situations for one party or the other. There just aren't very many of these genuine swing districts that could go back and forth.
I hate safe congressional districts. I don't like them for Dems. I don't like them for the GOP because I think it makes elected officials more partisan, playing more to the tails of the bell curve, if you will, and frankly, just less responsive to their voters' true interests and concerns. Professor Franklin, I want to turn to you. There was so much fascinating insight in this newest poll. You put a poll out following the assassination of Charlie Kirk. You asked about political violence. You asked about the president's overall approval rating. You always do that. But you asked about confidence in institutions, in the Federal Reserve, in the Supreme Court. You talked about redistricting. Give folks a little bit of a top line of where sentiments are in this moment where we have had extraordinary, I think, dislocations, and both Democrats and conservatives are concerned about political violence.
Yeah, on political violence, I think the first thing is to say that 89% say political violence or violence for political purposes is never justified. So this is an overwhelming majority that on that measure oppose political violence, though 11% say maybe under some circumstances. But what's really striking is that when you ask who's more responsible for political violence, the left or the right, it's about evenly divided, and a small majority, 51%, say both sides are responsible. But when you look among Republicans, it's 53% that blame the left, only 4% that say the right is responsible. And when you look at Democrats, it's 51% blame the right and just 3% blame the left. By comparison among independents, 89% say both. Mm. And so this is really an example of how we see the flaws in our opponents very readily, but we don't see any problems on our own side. And it's just striking how large those gaps are and how mirror images Democrats and Republicans are of each other in just seeing the problem as being one on the other side, or substantially seeing the problem on the other side. On redistricting, we don't see much support for redistricting in the middle of a term to the middle of a census. Every 10 years, we do redistricting after a new census. But to do it now to maximize the party's strength within states that they have a majority, and usually almost always that means having control of both houses of the legislature and the governorship. That's what's allowing Republicans to redistrict in Texas and Missouri and North Carolina. Well, North Carolina is divided, but Indiana. And that kind of control at the state level has opened up the ability now, and now that there's will from the White House and from the parties, to maximize the party advantage. That really does upset the political balance for the rest of the decade, and of course threatens to make redistricting a biannual affair instead of a once-a-decade affair.
To the chagrin of every single person that has ever been responsible for trying to draw maps, I'm going to put my hand up and advise the Milwaukee County's Independent Redistricting Commission. It is really difficult to do. Professor Burden, let me kind of zoom out and ask a very, very high-level question. People seem to exist in their own information bubbles. Facts are rejected by folks on opposing sides of the aisle all the time. If people are existing in their own factual universes, whether perceived or real, and we have increasing polarization and a seeming willingness, I would say especially from the right, to lean into polarization, how do we continue to ensure that people are engaging and that it's not just TikTok engagement, right? That it's not just the politics of soundbite? Because I think we could all agree, whether you tend to lean left or right, that politics and policymaking by whose soundbite does better on social media is not a good way to craft public policy or to answer some of the most challenging questions in our time, like immigration, public health, how to make public education effective, right? How to make sure that we've got a secure, insulated voting system, right? That we're meeting, again, foreign policy challenges, all of these things, they're complicated. They're not soundbite material, and yet that seems to be how folks are engaging.
Oh, you've asked a tough one here. This is a really difficult problem. I mean, it's maybe the number one umbrella problem facing American politics. How do we get out of the death spiral we seem to be in? There are some big ideas out there, like introducing more political parties. Campaign finance reform, redistricting reform might be a smaller step along the way. Those things are probably not happening tomorrow. So it's a question of, you know, what can happen in the next election cycle that might engage people and have them believe in the effectiveness of the political system. I think there are a few ways of doing that. One is to remind people that previous elections have actually been meaningful and changed the direction of government. Whether you like the Affordable Care Act, which actually most Americans do, or you're unhappy with it now, it was an election that made that possible back in 08, and then it was subsequent elections that helped take pieces of it down. What's happening in Ukraine or Gaza or with Medicaid or anything else, those are all the results of elections. Here in Wisconsin, we really feel it. A small change of 20,000 votes in a governor's election really sets the state in a different direction. So unfortunately, it's kind of knife-edge politics, very competitive and decided by small margins, but the elections are meaningful, and I think reminding people of that goes a long way.
Professor Franklin, we've got just about a minute left. I wanted to ask you this question. Overall, Donald Trump's approval ratings are pretty terrible. He's not negative by a margin. They have been sliding slowly, more negative. And many of his policies are viewed net negatively. And yet, Democrats also have a massive approval problem. First of all, let's correct the record on those facts very briefly. And then when we come back on the other side, we're going to deal with what I think is sort of, it seems like oxymoronic that both of these things are true at the same time. But Professor Franklin, if you can establish the facts of approval on either side of the aisle at this point.
Yeah, President Trump's job approval is at 43% in our national poll from last week. It's about 41% in most of the polling averages. That has trickled down from the high 40s since he first entered office. So it's not a collapse, but it is a steady, small decline from month to month. And on the party side, about 42% have a favorable view of the Republican Party. But that drops into the high 30s, about 36% favorable to the Democrats. And a lot of that comes from Democrats who are very disappointed with their party right now. Doesn't mean they'll vote against them, but it does mean the party has a problem with its base.
And therein lies the rub, folks. We're going to get into these conundrums on the other side with these two very smart gentlemen, Professor Burden of the University of Wisconsin at Madison and Professor Franklin of UW Law School, both of which are my alma maters, by the way. Stick with us, folks. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
Are National Guard troops generally trained in law enforcement? No. National Guard troops like those President Donald Trump deployed to American cities in recent months to crack down on crime are not generally trained in law enforcement. For example, police officers in Washington, D.C. receive 21 training modules in criminal procedure, but Guard members receive none. Their primary training is focused on crowd control. Milwaukee's police union president suggested troops should be sent to Wisconsin's largest city. Governor Tony Evers called National Guard troops the, quote, wrong people, unquote, for fighting crime. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Read more at wisconsinwatch.org.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
This is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Have you ever found yourself asking,
what's a recipe for cookies my kids will love?
How do I avoid giving my guests food poisoning?
How would a restaurant chef prepare this meal?
If so, then tune into The Kitchen's Open, the show within the morning show each Monday morning at the start of the 10 o'clock hour. I'll tackle topics, teach techniques, or tell you what to do or not to do when it comes to cooking or the kitchen. I'll also bring you interviews with local chefs and restaurant owners. The Kitchen's Open, brought to you by the Hotel Mead. We'll tell you something good.
Teachers are diverse, skilled leaders, innovating to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Teaching shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you might be detecting a wee bit of a music vibe change today, I will be the one to tell you. It was at my request. One of my favorite artists of all times, an artist named D'Angelo, passed away yesterday at the age of 51 from cancer. He has changed music in only three albums, so we're listening to some of his music this afternoon. I hope you all don't mind. We're going to get back to our incredibly important discussion with two professors from both of the schools that I went to for part of my higher education, Professor Barry Burden at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Professor Charles Franklin Polster extraordinaire from the Marquette University Law School. Let me start with you, Charles. The conundrum that we're going to talk about here is when pollsters ask pretty clear, straightforward questions about a variety of MAGA policies, and specifically Trump policies. Tariffs are a good example of this. You ask people about, do they feel like they're doing better off now than they were a year ago? Not really all that much. But the top line that I have seen when I look at polling, and the ACA is a perfect example of this. When it was first enacted, overwhelmingly net negative public polling on it. It is now the complete opposite, overwhelmingly net positive. So when you stack up the actual policies of Democrats and Republicans, Democratic policies generally are favored by either a plurality or a majority of Americans. And yet, as we were talking about right before the break, the Democratic Party is not doing well. And we're going to get to that second conundrum in a moment. But I wanted to get your reflections on this phenomena, this conundrum. And I think you hit on something that may be the source of this, a bit of our own tribalism.
There's no question our tribalism plays a big role, that it is hard to see the value in the other party's policies, just as their candidates either. And so we do dig ourselves into trench warfare, really. Our side's good, the other side's bad. We very rarely give credit to the other side when it, you know, produces a genuine policy success. There are a couple of exceptions right now. One is pretty wide recognition on Trump's policy on the southern border, where 55-56% approve of the job he's done on handling border security. That falls to about 46% or so on how he's handling immigration, a different kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Majorities in the high 50s or low 60s support deporting immigrants in the U.S. illegally, but a majority oppose deporting those who don't have a criminal record. And so it really depends on how you frame the question for where you come down. And on Trump policies, tariffs have been terribly unpopular since February, when he first started announcing his tariff policy. And people are very negative about how he's handling inflation. Now, remember, that was a problem for Joe Biden. He was very unpopular for handling inflation, too. The one thing is that the party's images across a number of issues favor Republicans. If you ask not, do you approve or disapprove of Trump's handling of these issues, but do you think Republicans would do a better job handling the economy or Democrats would do a better job handling the economy? A majority say Republicans would do a better job, even though Trump's approval rating on handling the economy is quite negative. And we see this across a number of issues, that except when it comes to health care, where Democrats have a strong advantage, the party's images are more positive for Republicans across a range of issues, even though Donald Trump is net negative on all except the southern border.
It's truly fascinating. And the questions that you pointed out, Professor Franklin, how you ask them, at what level of specificity you're asking these questions, points out to me what I'm going to generalize, and I'll let you guys limit my generalization here. But it really points to this phenomena that has existed amongst or between Republicans and Democrats for quite some time. Republicans, excellent at top line, cut through the noise messaging. They get everybody on message. It's platitudinal, right? Whereas you've got Democrats dealing with the particulars, talking about specific things, asking those second level down questions about not, do you agree that people who are here illegally should be deported? But should Donald Trump be using military-esque deportation tactics with masked soldiers to deport people that have no criminal record? And that, to me, is what is so fascinating here. Professor Burden, if you can still hear me, do you see this sort of what I'm going to call platitudes versus particulars as one of the downdrags for Democrats over the last decade or so? I think we may have lost Professor Burden, so I'm just going to ask my other expert. Do you think, Professor Franklin, in terms of messaging, that tension between, again, platitudes and particulars amongst Democrats and Republicans has been one of those downdrags or impediments to Democrats being able to cut through in a more effective way?
Yeah, I think messaging plays an important role, and at least among Democrats, there's often frustration that their party doesn't message as effectively as Republicans do. Now, I don't quite buy that. I don't think one party has cornered the market on good messaging. But, you know, the broad, pithy comment is better than the detailed technical comment.
Something I would do well to remember, given my current occupation. It's not a legal argument, Manny. It's a radio show. We're going to come back. We're going to go get Professor Burden. We're going to continue with Professors Burden and Franklin talking about the state of our Democratic small d dialogue in this country. You can join us, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. Stick with us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
Farm news that impacts you and your community from the Midwest Farm Report throughout your day on 97.5 WFHR.
For WFHR and WIRI News, I'm Melissa Kay. As the climate shifts, so does the science behind growing cranberries. Staff at the Wisconsin Cranberry Research Station are working to ensure the future of the state's signature fruit by studying how cranberries can tolerate extreme temperatures and finding ways to extend the harvest season to reduce labor and equipment demands.
The inability to change in a changing environment is the textbook definition of extinction.
That's Grant Hawley, the executive director of the nonprofit Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association. He said Wisconsin growers know what to do when change happens slowly.
When you're looking at fast changes, you need to know the whys. And that's where our researchers come into play.
They're able to look at changes happening at a molecular level and see how the cranberries are being affected and also the symbiotic relationship that plants have with other organisms in the ground.
They're seeing how that bacteria inside of the soil is helping with nitrogen uptake. They're making sure that the fungus in the ground is helping us with water uptake.
Gabby Myers is the Research and Education Manager for the Wisconsin Cranberry Research and Education Foundation. She coordinates efforts from researchers across the state.
They're trying to create better cranberries, so maybe they're sweeter, firmer. So all different sorts of traits that they're trying to breed for. We provide a space for them to have those plots established.
Hybrid cranberry varieties are helping farmers diversify their marshes, producing more fruit on less land, and spreading out the harvest season.
They're trying to be able to make it to where harvest doesn't all happen in the same 2 weeks, because that's where you need extra equipment, you need extra people. It's just a terrible time if you have to do that.
Harvest season now starts as early as September and can run through October or later, depending on the year.
Now a singular family can actually start handling a medium to small size farm.
I'm Melissa Kay for WFHR and WIRI News.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Yahoo Entertainment is reporting big changes at Apple TV Plus. Just how big? They are removing the Plus, so it will just be Apple TV. I realize that only sounds like a typing issue, but Apple says their new identity will be vibrant, despite removing a positive character from the company name. This is a similar form of identity crisis as the one HBO Max went through when it became Max and now is transitioning back to just HBO. That's like Pepsi Cola dropping the Pepsi part and just calling it Cola. Maybe now that Apple TV is removing the Plus means they will minus the price that they just increased by $3 a month to $12.99. Can't blame a guy for trying. It's been over 2 hours since Taylor Swift has introduced a new product for Swifties to empty their pockets for. Well, time is up, as Tay-Tay has announced a new 6-episode Disney Plus series titled The End of an Era. The show will follow her Eras tour, makes sense, and the final episode will be a concert video of the tour. The masterpiece drops December 12th. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight, maybe a stray shower and a low in the mid-40s. A cloudy day for tomorrow, showers around, highs upper 50s to near 60. A mostly cloudy day for Friday and warmer, a high in the low 70s with a slight chance of rain. Right now it's 53.
He scores! Wow! He ripped one over the glove of Heaney!
It's on!
And save! Badgers win the shootout!
In America's college hockey capital.
Empty net goal at the horn! Badgers finish Michigan!
Badger hockey lives here.
Sponsored by Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep, Econ Electric Inc., Rapids Transmission, Junkyard Bar & Grill, and 8th Street Auto. Listen on 97.5 FM and on the Civic Media app.
Retirement can be scary, but only if you're not prepared.
That's why AARP created thisispretirement.org. Because unless you've already retired, you're in pretirement and you still have time to plan. Learn about retirement savings options, potential tax breaks, and how you can build savings over time. Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan and feel the retirement fear disappear. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll be live from WXCO in Wausau, Wisconsin for their open house. Chad Holmes from XCO is along, as well as Dan Schaefer on the recombobulation area on politics. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm joined by two great experts this hour to explore where we are collectively as Americans in this moment, why we're seeing some of the electoral outcomes that we are seeing. And we've been exploring two conundrums. My word, not the experts. Two conundrums. We're going to get back into conundrum one and move on to conundrum two. But let me reintroduce you to these great guests helping us all get a little bit smarter. We've got Professor Barry Burden of the University of Wisconsin, Madison Professor of Political Science and Director of their Elections Research Center. We also have Professor Charles Franklin, Marquette University Law School's pollster. He joins us frequently. I'm so pleased to have you both with us. Professor Burden, before we lost you at the tail end of the last segment, I wanted to ask you about conundrum one. And I thought Charles queued it up very well. We are all becoming, and generally speaking, not just in Wisconsin, but beyond, a bit more tribal. Less folks swinging or splitting tickets, less votes, less folks flipping from a Democratic presidential vote in one cycle and then voting for a Republican. But beyond that, what I have seen just generally overall is that when questions are asked that are quite specific about what I'm going to call signature top line Democratic policies and priorities, they do pretty well. You either get a plurality or over a slight majority. Whereas when you drill down with some of the MAGA policies, with Donald Trump's policies, folks get pretty uncomfortable with those. So to engage the dialogue, and you could drill down even more and say the more informed people get, the more news they consume, those striations are even more extreme, more acute. I call this the platitude versus the particulars. I think Republicans are very good at top line pithy messaging. I think Democrats, well, you know, people who are undocumented do get free health care because Ronald Reagan passed EMTALA, and if they have a broken bone or they have a heart attack, instead of saying it's illegal and it's been that way since the Medicare Act was adopted. Do you see the same phenomena that Democrats tend to struggle with messaging? They're in the details. I mean, it conjures up recollections of Al Gore and the black box and the interwebs, but I won't go down that lane of memory too far. Professor Burden, what do you think about this conundrum?
Well, I think it's right, and it basically is consistent with political science research about this. So a really terrific book I'll just plug, I have no financial connection to, called Asymmetric Politics by Grossman and Hopkins, that points out that these are not two equivalent parties on the opposite sides of a mirror. They're pretty different entities. Democrats do tend to win when the discussion is about specific policies, not on every policy, but on many. The public is on the liberal or Democratic side of lots of those things. It's not just today. It's not just during Trump. It's decades of truth on that. Republicans tend to be advantaged when the discussion is about broad principles. You called them platitudes. I think in the book they call them themes or something. Mm. So when the discussion is about ideas like freedom, security, liberty, Republicans dominate. They would like elections and debates to be in those terms, and Democrats would like to argue about what the benefits level should be for Medicaid in your state. Yes. That's harder to communicate about. It's a more diverse set of things, and it's in the weeds. And then Democrats have this other thing that makes them different. They have groups. Now we call them the groups, the online groups, but actually they've always been there. The Democratic Party has been a coalition of kind of different interests, and the Republicans don't have that same difficulty. They have their own challenges in putting a coalition together, but it's not the same. And then I think layered on top of this basic difference between the parties is the Democrats are really struggling to communicate right now. There's no party leader. If you ask people in surveys who they think is the spokesperson for the Democratic Party, you get some answers. There's some Kamala Harris's, there's some Barack Obama's, there's some Chuck Schumer's, and a bunch of other people who might be presidential candidates in a few years or other things. The chair of the Democratic National Committee, unknown to the public. So there's this vacuum in terms of communication, and that, I think, magnifies the problem Democrats generally have of trying to communicate about so many policies.
Folks, again, we're joined by Professors Franklin and Burden from, respectively, Marquette University Law School and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. CJ, do you have a question or comment for the professors?
Hey there, Maggie. Thank you for taking my call. There's so much I'd love to ask them about, but, you know, I wonder about the violence, the political violence. I'm wondering if they heard from or read the Conjugal Network Institute study that was done through Rutgers University. That towards political violence on which party they consider assassination okay. And the mere fact that Dr. Franklin said 11% said it's okay is scary. One thing that you said, Maggie, is how they've gone into our political camps, you know, both left and right. But one thing, like the professors to speak of, one thing that has changed, black males. Black males decided to vote for Republican higher than any time in their history, and partially because they're tired of being promised that the government is the answer. It's not the answer.
I think there's a lot of complexity going on with some of, especially racial demography and what we're seeing, but I wanted to give you both, respectively, an opportunity to address perceptions of actual incidents of political violence. First, let's turn to you, Professor Franklin, and the perceptions of political violence. And to be clear, I didn't understand your polling question to ask about, is an assassination okay? You asked a generic question about political violence.
No, that's right, and that's a good point. Other polls have shown this, and it's not surprising, that if you ask about assassination, you get 1% or less who say that's okay. When you ask about threatening, you get small percentages. When you ask of is political violence ever appropriate or ever called for, then that's our question, and that's the 89% opposed, 11% in favor. In favor in the sense of saying it can sometimes be justified. Now, you can see an answer to that from both the left and the right. You know, there are folks on the right that would say the American Revolution was an act of political violence that was fully justified. And you can see people on the left saying protests in the streets that include some violence actions are sometimes necessary for change. Dr. King did not agree with that. Famously, the civil rights movement that he built was built on the principles of nonviolence. So I don't think this is an easy question. This is also one where it's 11% that say it's sometimes acceptable, but that rises to nearly 20% among people who call themselves very liberal, and around 20% for people under 30. And so this is an example where, at least in the wake of Charlie Kirk's shooting, people on the left were a little more likely, still far from a majority, but a little more likely to say violence could sometimes be acceptable than were people on the right. However, I would also say when you ask how big a problem is political violence, after Republicans like Charlie Kirk were shot, then it's a bigger majority on the Republican Party that say it's unacceptable. But after the Minnesota Democratic legislators were shot and one killed and her husband killed, then it was Democrats saying it was more important, Republicans saying it's not as important. And so across five or six acts of recent political violence, we've seen this in the polls every time, that if it was your person who was attacked or shot or beaten, you're more likely to say it's important and your opponent's less likely to say it's important. And then that flips just as soon as the shoe's on the other foot.
Professor Burton, political violence historically in this country, civil disobedience, which some might actually consider to be political violence. I mean, again, the terms can be amorphous. What is your view of the relationship between voter engagement and turnout and this extremism and political violence, which has affected folks from both the right and the left?
Boy, it's a good question. I don't think we know the answer to that. It's a relatively new thing in the United States. Other democracies have experienced violence around elections in particular in a way the U.S. just does not have that history until the last 5 years or so, kind of January 6th forward, and some of these movements that have cropped up, Proud Boys and others. So I don't think we know. It's distasteful to most Americans, and I think the polling that Charles has mentioned verifies that. I don't know whether it generally scares people away from politics. It's another reason to not be engaged, because now there's a danger involved and it just is beyond the pale, or whether it alarms people and it, you know, and they want to resolve it by other means, and so it encourages them to show up at protests and send money to their favorite candidates and to get out in the midterms.
Yeah, it's a question that I think the next couple of election cycles will shed an incredible amount of light upon. I just want to say this, CJ, if you're still listening, please do send me the link to whatever study it was that you were referring to. The vast majority of objective research that I've seen does indicate that the overwhelming majority of acts of specific political violence over the last 50 years have come from the right. There are, of course, acts of political violence by folks on the left. It exists from both sides, but simply the raw numbers and, again, objective independent analysis that is longitudinal, covering a quite a large span of time, show that it has been overwhelmingly coming from the right. Let's talk about conundrum number two. We're going to cue this up, and we're going to talk about it on the other side as well. I know Professor Franklin might not want to wade into these conundrum number two waters too deeply, but as we were referencing before, Professor Burton, Democrats have always been this big tent party. They always have multiple constituencies that, frankly, for a very long time, have held differing views about what I'm going to call evolution versus revolution, or incrementalism versus wholesale change. And even our caller CJ mentioned dissatisfaction creeping up with Democrats amongst constituencies that have been so historically reliable constituencies for Democrats. I do personally think some of that is overblown. Black folks, brown folks, Jewish folks, women folks still tend to vote for Democrats. But we have seen movement in the last few years. What is, if you can, in your expert words, describe what I'm calling conundrum number two, which is Democrats with policies that are generally preferred have a messaging problem, and they also have a, hey, can we get it together, everybody, to win this next election problem?
I think it's a real problem with communicating to the people who are concerned about a certain set of issues. And it varies, of course, but look at how Democrats have fallen lower and lower and lower among rural voters over the last 20 years. And this is predates Donald Trump as well.
Yes.
Trump has accelerated it, but didn't create it. There is a big problem to speaking to the constituents that aren't on your side. Mm. And I think that's true of both parties, but it especially affects Democrats' inability to communicate with the groups that they've been losing support with, including working class voters. Non-college graduates have shifted from Dem to Rep.
Let's talk about that conundrum with Professor Burton on the other side. This is the conundrum. Who is getting served by which policies? And do people actually understand that? We're going to continue this discussion on the other side with my special guests and you, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In recent weeks, the level of activity from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has increased quite a bit. There was a raid in Manitowoc at a Walmart parking lot where dairy workers were known to congregate, a series of arrests in Madison, and in Milwaukee, ICE is looking to expand its operations significantly by seeking office space downtown to go along with a new field office on the city's northwest side. This has been concerning for many, and not without reason. A recent large-scale ICE raid in an apartment building in Chicago saw reports of armed federal agents breaking down doors, U.S. citizens detained for hours on end, and children being dragged from their homes in the middle of the night. While the American immigration system has a host of problems, this kind of violent show of force is not an acceptable way to address these problems. And ICE also just received an injection of $45 billion in the One Big Beautiful Bill, so it is imperative for all of us to hold ICE accountable and speak out when things go too far. Right now, things are going way too far.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
You can't escape a traffic jam. Know what else you can't escape? Seasonal allergies. And you might think you can avoid that coffee stain until... Oh, really? You can't escape a lot of things in life. But you can escape prediabetes. Prediabetes captures 1 in 3 adults. There are usually no signs of prediabetes. In fact, most people don't even know they have it. But with early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Take action by taking the 1-minute risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org. You might not be able to escape having this song stuck in your head, but you can escape prediabetes. Go to doihaveprediabetes.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Everybody, it's our last segment on this Wednesday. I've been so privileged and happy to be joined by our friend Charles Franklin, pollster from Marquette University Law School, and Professor Barry Burden of the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Got a plug again. I got to go to both of these fine universities, so thank you both so much for what you do to educate young people in our Wisconsin communities. Professor Burden, I wanted to ask you about what I am terming conundrum number two. And that is, and as Professor Franklin rightly pointed out, Democrats, despite the fact that their policies writ large over the last 50 years, and you could go back to FDR and that entire period of time, the New Deal, if you will, that these policies help working people, that they're trying to increase access and opportunity. Setting aside the specifics, we're seeing drifts and a difficulty of Democrats not only to identify who's speaking for the party on a national platform, but what the hell is the party actually trying to say about the things that are consistently the most important to the vast majority of Americans, which, broadly speaking, is, are my kids going to do better than I am? Am I going to be able to retire? Do I feel like our economic system is working well for us? And that is where most Americans, correctly in my opinion, as an economist, feel like they're getting screwed and it's not working well. But Democrats can't seem to capitalize on that. What's going on with conundrum number two?
Well, first, there's the communications problem I mentioned. There's no one speaking for the party. There's no agreement on who ought to be speaking for the party or who represents it. And the Democrats have been struggling since 2016 to figure out how to work in an environment where Donald Trump is on the other side. He is like a machine gun, you know, just sending things along in an unpredictable way all the time. And Democrats have not yet come up with a strategy that's been successful. You know, they've defeated him at times, but how to offer alternative communication just has not come there. And it's surprising because Democrats, people on the left, agree on one thing. They all dislike Donald Trump an awful lot. Charles's polling will show that. I think his approval rating is in the single digits among Democrats, self-identified Democrats. So you would think that would bring the party together and make it easy for them to look past their differences. And there aren't a lot of differences. Democrats are in agreement on lots of things, but there are these few items, the war in Gaza, immigration, gender, trans rights issues that are dividing Democrats along some generational lines and to some degree along racial and ethnic lines. That was the issue that CJ mentioned at the end of his call. So it's created some cleavages and Democrats get tripped up on that and have trouble dealing with the internal divides and combating Trump simultaneously. It's just not working at the moment.
Here's my question. I have found it incredibly difficult to get Democrats to engage on this point with me. I want to have a discussion with them about, can Democrats say, here are the top three or four policy priorities. These are the things that we want defining that platform going forward for Democrats. These are the messages that are going to cut through. I think in addition to the problem of platitudes versus particulars, it's the plethora, right? If I'm going to lean into the alliteration, Democrats talking about all of the things all of the time at this very, very detailed level and missing the forest for all of the trees or the leaves. How have Democrats shown any aptitude for this, or is that simply a reflection of the lack of an agreed upon national leader for the party?
Well, I think there is a push on the Democratic side of things to talk about these bread and butter issues, to criticize the administration for how it's handling inflation and kind of the basic living experiences of people. Now it's going to be the healthcare subsidies that are going to maybe expire, and people will be feeling that in a pretty direct way in the next couple of months if it happens. So that is one area where I think moderates and progressives, if you want to think of those as the two camps in the party or the young and the establishment, are in agreement that they missed the boat in communicating that when they were in office under Joe Biden. You remember the signature policy maybe of the Biden administration was the Inflation Reduction Act. So misnamed. It wasn't intended to do much about inflation. And then, of course, it failed to do anything about it since that was not its goal. And so Biden was blamed for that along with lots of other things. And I think Democrats seeing some of their working class base trickle away and facing this communication problem are likely to turn back in that direction to the bread and butter kinds of things, the minimum wage, healthcare, the old New Deal kinds of issues that have worked for them in the past.
Why has it taken so long to get that clarity for Democrats?
I don't know. I think some of it's the rise of these other issues, you know, the Black Lives Matter and the fallout from the George Floyd incident and policing were dominating for a while. COVID was the issue for a couple of years. Donald Trump is always the issue for Democrats. The Gaza war has really divided the party in some important ways. So it's hard. And with no leadership to speak for the party at the moment, it's hard to keep all that together.
Charles, you're going to end our hour this afternoon, Professor Franklin. What trends are you seeing or consistencies in public perception of both Democrats and the MAGA movement, as well as Trump and some potential Democratic national leaders?
Yeah, I think one thing is the image of the parties have changed over time. If we go back to early polling in the 1950s, if you ask about the parties, the thing that people said overwhelmingly was the Democrats were for the working people, Republicans were for business. And that image of the parties came out of the 1930s and the New Deal. Democrats still get an advantage on that, on things like Medicare and health care. But that broad image of the party as being for the working people just doesn't exist for the Democrats anymore. Instead, the image is much more shaped by, as Barry mentioned earlier, the groups, the individual groups, whether it's education or whether it's racial groups or whether it's gender groups. And that just doesn't have that broad appeal. Democrats are struggling to find a way to communicate to a broader audience than they are now what they're for and what they're not for. It's easy to say I'm against Donald Trump. That unifies the party, but it hardly convinces anybody that likes Donald Trump.
Professors, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. That's going to do it for me, folks. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it's always better when we stand together.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump said today he's authorized covert CIA operations in Venezuela.
Does the CIA have authority to take out Maduro?
Oh, I don't want to answer a question like that. That's a ridiculous question for me to be given. Not really a ridiculous question, but wouldn't it be a ridiculous question for me to answer?
Two more bodies of hostages were handed over today to Israel. That's 9 Hamas has returned out of 28. Senior U.S. advisors say many bodies could be buried under unexploded ordnance. CBS's Deborah Pata.
We spoke to hostage negotiator Gershon Baskin, who told us, sadly, some bodies may never be recovered. He said many of the Hamas commanders who buried the Israeli hostages were killed by Israel.
A federal judge today temporarily blocked the administration from firing federal workers during the government shutdown. Unions had challenged the legality of the firings. CBS News Brief, I'm Cammie McCormick.